The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is the seventh and final day of this seven-day sesshin here at Mountain Gate in northern New Mexico in July 2016, a very hot month here in these mountains. We haven't had any rain for a while, which makes it hotter, and the wind doesn't help make it any more moist. It's quite dry out because of the wind. However, there's some clouds in the sky, and we hope that perhaps they'll drop some rain on us here. There are only a few hours left in this sesshin. Sesshin means to touch the mind, to encounter the mind. And what is this mind that we're talking about? For a long, long time, Western science has assumed that the mind was a function of the brain. And yet, there's a big question about that now. Among other things, they've discovered that there are actually what are termed brain cells or nervous system cells in more than just the brain in the body. There are those in the heart and also in the intestinal tract, and they seem to communicate with the brain and vice versa. And it goes beyond there. Anyone who has delved deeply into meditation, or even people who have not, have discovered that mind can be far more than a collection of cells in the body. And, for that matter, when the body dies, what does happen? Where does the essence that was the human being that inhabited that body go? And where, even perhaps more importantly, did it come from before that body was born? We know that babies are created, children are created through the union of egg and sperm, and then the cells divide. And if everything works out well, then they divide more and more and become differentiated into different parts of the body. And after approximately 9 months, a child emerges, and lo and behold, that little baby has already a personality of its own. How did that happen? What part of what cell that went into creating that little body, if any, contained the personality? And if it wasn't embedded in the genetic makeup, which seems highly unlikely, where did it come from? And when this body is still and stiff, where will it go? Where has it gone? Good questions to mull over. I'd like to continue sharing something of a book called Refining Your Life, From the Zen Kitchen to Enlightenment by Dogen and Uchiyama. Kosho Uchiyama is a Soto Zen master, and the viewpoint in this book is clearly Soto, and we won't go further than that in our comments about it. Kigen was considered, or is considered, the founder of Soto, the Soto sect in Japan. The Soto sect emphasizes what is called shikantaza, translated as just sitting. And it's not an easy thing to do. And these days, many people misunderstand it and assume that it simply means attention. We won't go into that, but the Soto sect is differentiated from the Rinzai sect, the two currently existing sects of Zen meditation, Zen Buddhism, Zen meaning meditation. The two are different in their form and also in their approach to practice. The Soto sect has people sitting facing a blank wall to imitate Bodhidharma, who, when he came from India in a perilous journey across the sea to southern China and discovered that the emperor, whose kingdom he first landed in while he was overtly Buddhist and had done a great many things to help support Buddhism, had ordained monks. By that I mean that the government required an official sanction for each monk to be ordained. In other words, it was the government that decides that a monk was going to undergo ordination, assuming that the monk had asked to, or the person who was going to become a monk had asked to become a monk. It was not the decision of the monk himself, nor was it the decision of his master. It was the decision of the government. But Emperor Wu had caused any number of monks to be ordained, and built many, many monasteries through government funding, and had underwritten the translation of Buddhist texts, and he felt like he'd done a great deal for Buddhism. And so, just to double check that and see what an accountant might say with regard to how much good karma he had as a result of doing that, when Bodhidharma arrived in his court and it was clear that Bodhidharma was a deeply important, at least, Buddhist monk from India, the source of Buddhism, he asked Bodhidharma, he first listed all the things he'd done, then asked Bodhidharma what merit he got from all of that, and he was shocked when Bodhidharma said, none. And the emperor then asked, if there's no merit, then what is there? And Bodhidharma replied, vast emptiness and nothing to be called holy. Vast emptiness and nothing to be called holy. And the emperor said, well, but aren't you a holy man? And Bodhidharma answered, I don't know. I don't know. And that I don't know was quite a profound response. But it was also clear to Bodhidharma that the emperor didn't have an affinity yet for practice. And Bodhidharma was there to teach the practice that would lead to awakening. Not talk about the sutras, not do any of the other things that monks and nuns were doing in those days, but to teach Zazen, because it does not seem that they had that aspect of Buddhism yet in China. Although China had received Buddhism several centuries before Bodhidharma supposedly arrived, it was the sutras, it was chanting, it was becoming a monk and studying the sutras. That was the way, apparently, when Bodhidharma arrived in China. So he left and found a cave above Shaolin Monastery, which these days is famous for a kind of martial art that may or may not have some connection with Bodhidharma. And he sat facing the stone wall of the cage of the cave for 9 years, it is said, before finally the monk Eka Daishi, that's how he's spoken of in Japan, Huike in Chinese, came upon him, found him, probably searched him out, because there was probably word he had gotten all the way to Eka Daishi, who was an expert on the sutras, had studied them for 30 years, but was still restless because he felt like something was missing in his practice life. And so he was searching Bodhidharma to find out what he was missing and try to fulfill that loss. So Bodhidharma's facing the wall was the model for the Soto sect. I'm not quite sure when and where the Rinzai sect took to sitting facing into the room, but it became a koan for me the entire time I was training at Sogenji, which is a Rinzai monastery, and during which we sat facing each other in the rectangular zendo, as compared to facing the wall in a square zendo, which is the typical Soto style. And because my experience in Rochester had been that the effect, the use of what in Soto Zen is called the Kyosaku, the short encouragement stick, was used in a way that helped people go deeper in their practice. It's never meant to be abusive, but it has turned out to be a source of abuse in some of the monasteries in Japan, which have lost the real understanding of Zen practice. And it's turned into a hazing tool instead. But at any rate, in Rochester, it's used very effectively to help people go deeper. At the same time, there are people who have a very strong and deep and painful response to the Kyosaku, and often people who have been abused, even if they are not struck themselves, have a great deal of pain on hearing anybody else struck. So that entered into the decision too. In the Rinzai system, the Kesaku, as it's called, is considerably longer because it's struck from the front of the person. And the use is for the same purpose, to help a person deepen their practice. It can instantly help a person drop extraneous thinking and so on and so forth. But here our Zendo is rather small. And many people who come here have a history of abuse. So the last time it was used and I saw fear in people's eyes, I made the decision not to use it again. And we have not used it for many, many years at this point. One of the curious side effects of that was one student was alarmed at the decision not to use it anymore. And it turned out that that person, and other people can have the same problem, was actually addicted to receiving the Kyosaku in Rochester, the Kesaku in Mountain Gate. Our practice is about relying on ourselves. And if we have to have an external impetus to help us clear our mind, then it's a dangerous position to be in, because then we're dependent on something else for clarity. It's more of a struggle, perhaps, to find that clarity naturally within oneself, but if we do, then we are so much better off for having done that. And so we don't use the keisaku here. So the Rinzai form also includes koan practice in a very traditional way, in which each koan is considered, is worked on as a breakthrough koan. It's not Shkantaza, when it's done properly, can be a very deep practice. But it takes a great deal of experience to learn how to do that properly. And if we are simply following our breath, for example, that's not Shkantaza. Or simply paying attention, that's not Shkantaza. Shkantaza is reaching such a depth, it would really be called samadhi, where the mind is not, it's not got anything in it. It's a place of choiceless awareness. But the Rinzai system of working on koans, in particular with the extended out-breath, is a very, very effective practice that even beginners can find extremely helpful and rapidly deepening. And so that's what we use here. Knowing the difference between these two, Dogen, while he was deeply realized, at present, since the early 1900s, I'm told, the Soto sect has officially said that it is not necessary to have had Kensho to become a Zen teacher. And unfortunately, that leaves the Zen teacher with a handicap, because ultimately, to come to awakening is a fundamental purpose of practice. And then to integrate that awakening into our daily life continues that purpose. To help with that, it's important to have a teacher who has gone through that process, at least to a certain degree, at least to the point of having had a sanctioned Kensho experience and further deepening practice. Because otherwise, how can you guide students to awakening? But that said, there are some important points in this book. And I'd like to share some of them. This is really a book of commentary by Kosho Uchiyama, who is the abbot of Antaiji in Kyoto, a very small temple. It's his comments on some of Dogen's writings, specifically what is known as the Tenzo Kyokun, the how to cook your life, basically. The information on the teachings that Dogen has given on being Tenzo. And he is using being Tenzo, the position of Tenzo, as a metaphor for how to express your life in terms of Zen practice. Practice and action, really. And so there's another commentary, a more recent commentary done by some Westerners that's titled How to Cook Your Life, which is really closer to the meaning of Dogen. He was both giving instructions to his monks on how to practice in action in the monastery as the specific position of Tenzo, but it was also a metaphor for how to practice deeply, how to bring practice to life in everything we do or say or think. So these are Uchiyama Roshi's words. All too often, while we while away our lives, we're creating general assumptions and ideologies out of the thoughts that arise in our minds. And after having fabricated those ideas, we finally dissipate our life energy by living in the world we have abstracted from them. Our conditioning brings about thoughts, ideas, assumptions about our life, about ourselves, particularly the self-image is created through conditioning. And we live through the lens of that conditioning. And our thoughts go right along with it. The conclusions we draw from the experiences we have through that filter, which are necessarily, because they're filtered, skewed from reality, then that makes for more assumptions and generally a life filled with a certain amount of suffering. In our practice of Zazen, we are working to let go this conditioning by really seeing through it, seeing the falsity of it, and not substituting anything in its place. And that second part is absolutely vital. We can't trust what we think. Many, many, many years ago, I suddenly realized that I couldn't trust what I thought. For one thing, depending on my mood and what anybody else had just said to me, my thoughts were of different colorations. So which one was accurate? And if I had to choose between which one was accurate, then maybe none of them were accurate, because the one I would choose as accurate depended on the moment. It's a little bit like Flora Courtois, who collected affirmations as a teenager, and every time she experienced something new happened, she ran to her scrapbook of affirmations to choose the affirmation that fit the moment. And she was always dismayed to discover that once the moment was gone, the affirmation no longer fit the next moment. And so she began seeking for a deep underlying truth that was always true. And that is what we are doing in our Zazen. We have thoughts coming in and out of our minds, and we treat them like the clouds in the sky. We just let them come and go. We don't get involved with them, either by chasing them down or by trying to prevent them from happening. They come and they go. And our interest and our focus is much deeper. We're searching really for the very source of our being. And the thoughts are not going to give us much of a clue. And they're certainly not going to point to the source of our being. Much of our thoughts are what Kepler-Rush used to term thoughting, just fragments of commentary, fragments of songs, sudden sentences that appear out of nowhere for no reason. It's the dregs of the mind. And we keep it going unwittingly, because if we're not thinking, to reverse what Descartes has said, are we going to disappear? I think, therefore I am. He was pretty right on that. But who is I am? What is I am? Here that we have this living, breathing body that moves around and interacts and does things and sleeps and eats and all the rest and has moods and has interests and enjoys and gets discouraged and feels needy about certain things. All of us have that going on. What's at the basis of it? What's beneath it? What's the source of this beingness that the most superficial level has us thinking, communicating in certain ways? Who are we? If we want to be truly free, we need to settle down, allow our mind to quiet deeply, and search for that. The thoughts won't give us the answer, so there's no point in getting involved with them. Let them be just background noise. And settle deep into your hara. Open to possibility. Because if you do it enough, long enough, completely enough, you will understand. And in that understanding, you will become free. This is why we do Zazen. And it works. Uchiyama Roshi adds, the most important thing to bear in mind when practicing Zazen is to completely let go of everything. When we do that, everything that arises can be viewed as the scenery of our lives and not necessarily the truth. And then a little bit more here. In the very beginning of the text, and here we're talking about the Tenzo Kyokun, Dogen Zenji talks about the importance of the Tenzo, cutting through the notion that this work is the same as that performed by, quote, an ordinary cook or kitchen helper, close quote, to state that, quote, the monks holding each office are all disciples of the Buddha and all carry out the activities of a Buddha, close quote. In other words, the text shows us that the Tenzo practice is the reality of life just as validly as those practicing Zazen. This is practice in action, a vital component of our practice. In Zen, this is called practicing single-mindedly with all one's energies. This attitude is completely different from the cut-and-dried assumptions people too often hold when looking at the world. Living by ordinary social or worldly values is a typical example of what I mean by living in a realm of fabricated thoughts and ideas and relative values. That is why our practice consists of cutting through the ordinary social and market values of things and human beings, and of practicing with a life attitude based upon the practice of reality, of the life of one's total self with a capital S. The Tenzo Kyokun is a cookbook on life, But what is the basic ingredient with which we prepare for this life? For Dogen Zenji, it was nothing other than Zazen. Religious life comes into existence by our asking how we can live with Zazen as the standard for our lives, while in turn being protected by a Zazen. Looking at from a slightly different angle, religious life becomes vital when Zazen begins to function in our everyday activities. Functioning in our everyday activities. It's so easy to assume that we're not doing real Zazen if we're not sitting on the cushion, regardless of whether it's facing in or facing out. That's a mistake. Zazen on the cushion is the underpinning of our life. It's vital. It's important to do it on a regular basis because it provides the basis for our doing Zazen in everything we do. How do we do Zazen in everything we do? We become so completely one with what we are doing, that there's no me doing anything. There is just chop, 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 and the carrots are cut. There's just zzz, 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 back and forth with the weed whacker, and the weeds are cut. It's just driving down the highway, totally absorbed in the moment, the experience of driving. And as part of all of that, it is recognizing when we are acting as a result of our filters, acting out of our conditioning, when we're drawing conclusions, more conclusions about ourselves or about people around us, as a result of our conditioning. Because it is the conditioning that we begin to see through as we're doing our Zazen. And that is vital. That is what brings us to liberation. Seeing where we're caught. And then living free from that caughtness. Thank you for listening. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.